Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. There's a push to decrease the use of lawn chemicals.
Once the fertilizer starts to work, you'll see the color improve.
Most lawns don't need phosphorus to begin with.
An inside look at the struggle for political power at West Virginia's capital.
You need a governor that can move quickly in times of emergency, such as floods, matters like that.
This is the time of year when certain wildflowers make their brief appearance.
This one is commonly called cat's toes or mouse's toes because it kind of looks like they're fuzzy little toes.
And quilters gather in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia to hone their craft.
And I'm learning the skill that I hope I pass on my quilts to my grandchildren and they become family heirlooms.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. For aficionados of the perfect grassy green lawn, this is the time of year to spread weed and feed, fertilizer to make the grass grow, and herbicide to get rid of anything that's not grass. But fertilizers spread on lawns, gardens, and farms have gotten a lot of attention for contributing nutrients that create harmful algae blooms in waterways like the Chesapeake Bay or Lake Erie. As the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports, international regulators and others are pushing Pennsylvania to ban some lawn fertilizers.
Michael Pelletier is spreading fertilizer pellets in the grass of a manicured park-like area behind a new business development.
Once the fertilizer starts to work, you'll see the color improve. The turf will fill in some of these thin areas and the shade will start to fill in a little more. It'll recover from the winter damage. The plants should be strong, healthy, dense turf.
Pelletier has been doing this kind of work for more than 30 years. But these days, fertilizer is getting a bad name because it can run off the land and into waterways. The Great Lakes, particularly Lake Erie, as well as the Chesapeake Bay, have been choked with algal blooms in recent years. And fertilizer ingredients such as nitrogen and especially phosphorus are getting much of the blame.
Well, it's fertilizer, and so what happens is when it runs off, it fertilizes the water, literally.
Dave Dempsey is a policy advisor at the International Joint Commission. The IJC regulates the lakes and rivers along the U.S.-Canadian border. Dempsey says nearly every state and province bordering the Great Lakes limits phosphorus and lawn fertilizers. In a report earlier this year, the IJC called on Ontario, Ohio, and Pennsylvania to take action as the only three without phosphorus bans. He says it's common sense.
Most lawns don't need phosphorus to begin with. Most have enough in the soil, or essentially just putting phosphorus on the ground to run off. We're wasting money as consumers, and we're creating an environmental problem.
Another call to action is coming from Pennsylvania's neighbors to the south, from the Chesapeake Bay Commission. It's a partnership between Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia to restore the health of the bay. The other members have put limits on nitrogen and phosphorus and lawn fertilizer sold in their states. Pennsylvania Senator Mike Brubaker of Lancaster County has introduced a similar bill in Pennsylvania. He says there's more grass fields than farm fields in the region.
There's more acres of grass than there is of field corn or wheat or oats or any other crop. So by putting a more moderate amount on, less will ultimately go into the water course and ultimately down to the Chesapeake Bay.
Brubaker's bill limits the nitrogen in lawn fertilizers and bans phosphorus, except in seed-starting fertilizers. And lawn care professionals like Michael Pelletier will need to get certified by the state to apply fertilizers. But some groups say the law won't help the Bay or Lake Erie and might even harm water quality. Greg Robertson is with the Pennsylvania Lawn and Nursery Association. He says most people don't fertilize enough. A healthy stand of lawn or turf grass holds on to lawn chemicals so they don't run off into waterways. Robertson says all the state laws ignore this.
They weren't paying any attention to the science. This basic assumption that if you put less fertilizer on, you'll get less pollution is in fact not true. And in fact, you fertilize to the point that you get a nice, dense, healthy stand of turf grass, and that actually reduces pollution.
While some researchers do agree a healthy lawn can better hold on to chemicals, using fewer chemicals has also worked. John Lehman is a biologist at the University of Michigan who's been studying the Huron River for more than a decade. He found a big change in 2008 after the city of Ann Arbor started limiting lawn fertilizers.
Frankly, I was quite surprised that even after the first year, we could see an effect.
Lehman says the ban reduced phosphorus in the river by 25%.
And if it was only 1 year, we'd have to think that that was perhaps coincidental. But we saw it repeated 3 years in a row.
Since then, the state of Michigan and others in the Great Lakes have passed limits on lawn chemicals. Lehman says the health of Lakes Michigan and Superior have improved in recent years. Lake Erie remains the most polluted with fertilizer nutrients and the most troubled with algal blooms. And while the international community and others push for Pennsylvania and Ohio to take action, lawn care professional Michael Pelletier says a fertilizer law will cost him and consumers more money, will be impossible to police, and make little difference for the environment.
I do not think this law is necessary. It's not in our best interest to over-fertilize a lawn and excessively use fertilizer. It's the most expensive product that we use.
Pelletier's company already uses fertilizers without phosphorus because it's not necessary for a healthy lawn and it saves money. And as more states have passed lawn chemical limits, most of those big bags on the shelves at Home Depot and elsewhere are also being formulated with zero phosphorus content. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. This has been a particularly snow-filled winter, and this past week we've seen a large amount of rainfall across much of the region. Conditions like this contribute to unstable ground and landslides. As West Virginia Public Radio's Glynis Board reports, one geologist from West Virginia University says there's more we can do to help prevent these landslides.
West Virginia has one of the greatest landslide risk of any in the country. We may, in fact, have the highest per capita landslide damage rate of any of the 50 states.
Steve Kite is the chair of the Department of Geology and Geography at West Virginia University. He says California might be the state that sees the most landslides, but again, per capita, West Virginians experience a lot of damaging effects from landslides. Steep slopes and prevalent shrink-swell soil components make for reliable land movement throughout the state's four seasons.
A lot of the cost of landslides are not so apparent because they're not so much in that landslides occur and we have to clean it up. A lot of the cost of landsliding is the prevention of landslides through things like retaining walls and structures that prevent fatalities and injuries and damage.
But more data is needed to get a better grasp on the land, so to speak. But
unfortunately, the U.S. Geological Survey has tens of thousands of stream gauge out there, but nothing comparable to that to detect and characterize landsliding. Mm-hmm. And almost none of the state geological surveys have an organized reporting system.
But Kite says new technology is changing the way we see the world. Light imaging and detecting radar, or LIDAR, is breaking new ground. No pun intended. Thousands of laser beams per second scan the Earth from their position attached to fixed-wing planes or helicopters flying through the air and create a map of the landscapes beneath with truly impressive accuracy.
If the data are processed, you can take out the trees and the buildings, and you can see what the true ground surface looks like. And these are amazing tools at picking up landslides if you know how to identify them.
While LIDAR can also help us identify some of the more problematic areas in the state where landslides have happened, Kite says it takes a trained eye to know where undisturbed land might be prone to slipping. To that end, Kite says West Virginia would do well to consider creating a professional licensure requirement for geologists.
31 states have this. If you go to a place like California or Colorado, before one can do a development, a geologist has to look at that property and sign off on the fact that it is stable enough to be built.
Kite says civil engineers and trained geologists would make a bang-up, knock-down development team for projects in West Virginia, so to speak. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Another bane of winter weather is potholes. Essayist Sarah Lowther Hensley has these observations about this seasonal problem.
You know the drill. eyes trained straight ahead, glued to that patch of pavement directly in front of you, picking and weaving and bobbing your way along the street. Yep, pothole season. That perennial pox of problematic pavement. Drivers miss a lot of beautiful scenery this time of year, just because we have to focus our gaze straight down and straight ahead. There's an illustration making the rounds on social media. You may have seen it. It compares the trajectory of drunk and sober drivers. Now, normally, sober drivers will drive in a straight line, and drunk drivers will bob and weave. In pothole land, it's the sober drivers who weave in and out and snake their way along the road. Drunk drivers just drive straight through the pothole minefield, oblivious, allowing their vehicle to dunk into hole after hole in a strut-busting, rim-rocking wave of destruction. Truth be told, sometimes, no matter your skill level and experience, you can't avoid all potholes. You're just going to have to come to terms with the fact that you'll hit some. I read someplace years ago that the worst thing you can do is slam on the brake if you realize you're about to hit a pothole. Now, I don't know if that's true, but if I can't avoid a pothole, I always do try to keep my foot off the brake pedal at that moment of impact, just in case. For me, there's also a series of involuntary and useless physical reactions to hitting a pothole. In that moment when I realize I'm about to hit one, my arms and legs stiffen, my shoulders scrunch up to my ears, and my hands put a death grip on the steering wheel, bracing for impact. And I actually lift myself up a bit off the seat, as if those actions will somehow soften the blow or keep the car from sinking quite so deep. I also grimace. Yeah, if I hold my mouth just right, that dang pothole won't damage my car quite as much. It's worth a shot. This spring, I have 4 new tires, a new alignment, and a healthy respect for the dangers of a hidden or carelessly missed crater. I'm doing my best to maneuver for minimum impact, but I'm still hitting my fair share. With warmer weather, the road crews are out addressing the problem, and I send out a big thank you to the guys and gals working hard to patch up this year's bumper crop of potholes. In the meantime, I wish you well on your journey, and in the words of that traditional blessing, may the road rise up to meet you.
Sarah Lowther Hensley is a former West Virginia Public Radio reporter and higher education administrator who lives in Fairmont, West Virginia. Her writing appears in her blog, Home Among the Hills. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In Kentucky, interest in this year's midterm election appears to be higher than usual. As Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter reports, a record number of people have registered to vote in advance of the May 20th primary.
3,105,349. That's the number of Kentuckians who are now registered to vote in advance of the primary on the 20th. The number is over a 2% increase from 2 years ago, according to the Secretary of State's office. There are about 400 seats up for a vote this year, from judgeships to state legislators, up to the hotly contested race for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Mitch McConnell. But the new numbers will only marginally affect the historically low turnout in primary elections. 2 years ago, only 16% of registered voters cast a ballot in the primary. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
Kentucky's Senate race has drawn a lot of candidates this year hoping to unseat the state's senior senator, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He faces 4 opponents in the Republican primary. Meanwhile, early voting in West Virginia's primary election began April 30th and runs through Saturday, May 10th. According to the Secretary of State's website, voters can cast ballots at each county courthouse or annex during regular business hours and on Saturday between 9 and 5. Primary election day is Tuesday, May 13th. The top of the ticket this year features races for 1 U.S. Senate seat and all 3 House seats. 2 of those seats are open because Senator Jay Rockefeller is retiring and Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito is running to replace him. West Virginia's primary is May 13th. After West Virginia's legislative session ended last month, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin made some line-item budget cuts and, in a move that is controversial, vetoed an abortion bill. That led to a debate over whether the legislature has the constitutional ability to override the governor's vetoes. West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Marr reports on this conflict between leaders in West Virginia's capital.
The question of gubernatorial power in West Virginia was forced into the spotlight after two decisions by Governor Earl Ray Tomlin following this year's legislative session. Two vetoes, to be more specific, the first of which came just days after the end of the extended budget session. Tomlin cut specific line items in the legislatively approved budget to the tune of $67 million, slashing family and senior services, a move that was not popular with many community action groups. Next, the hotly debated Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act was placed on his desk, a bill banning abortions in the state after 20 weeks. Tomlin vetoed the legislation as well, calling it unconstitutional. With lawmakers and activists up in arms over both decisions, the governor's powers were questioned. But the question is deeper than, is he able to veto a bill? That's obvious in the state's constitution. The question is the balance of power, one that leans in favor of the office of governor, the proper one for West Virginia? For that answer, why not look to a man who's held the position, West Virginia's 33rd governor, Bob Wise.
The governor of the state of West Virginia has, I believe, the power that he or she needs to carry out the duties of the executive.
Wise held the office from 2001 to 2005, but he's not coming from a strictly executive perspective. He served for 18 years in the U.S. House of Representatives and a two-year term as a state senator before that. Still, he says West Virginia has a strong executive form of government, but that's one that works well for a small state with a part-time, non-professional legislature.
You need a governor that can function on a daily basis. You need a governor that can move quickly in times of emergency, such as floods, matters like that. And you need a governor that can really present and prepare the budget, taking into consideration the other elected office holders, but at the same time, you need someplace where the buck stops, and that's the governor.
House Minority Leader Tim Armstead's concern with gubernatorial power is not over what's written in the Constitution itself. Instead, he sees it as a wearing away of the legislature's power.
I think the legislature's kind of ceded some of its power to the governor and kind of deferred a little too much to the governor. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a factor of what the Constitution gives the governor in terms of power, but just how much we've kind of given up power and authority of the legislature to the governor, almost voluntarily in a lot of ways.
Armstead believes the legislature is essentially giving away some of its authority to the governor, because typically he and legislative leaders are from the same political party. He says they defer to him when it comes to policy stances and budget priorities.
And a lot of it, I think, has been a factor of, you know, the same party being in control in both those, and they don't want to stand up to the governor in that sense.
Wise sees other areas where the strength of the legislature is slipping, like the power to override a veto. That constitutional power has been in question in recent weeks because of a lack of clarity.
They absolutely do have the right to override if they get their work done on time.
In the press, there's continuous coverage of the chaos of the final night of the legislative session, the last-minute debates and compromises, the votes that get squeezed in right before midnight. The whole thing can be exciting and exhausting. But Wise says it doesn't have to be that way. Now, this is where it gets complicated, but bear with me. This is important. For an explanation, we go back to the state constitution. Article 6 sets out legislative powers and says after a bill is passed, the governor has 5 days to consider it. If he chooses to veto the legislation, it returns to its originating chamber, where a simple majority can vote to override the veto. It then goes to the opposite house for the same vote, and if both houses agree, the veto is overridden. But that's only when the legislature is still in session. If lawmakers adjourn sine die, as they do at the end of each budget session, the governor has 15 days to approve or reject a bill. But there's no mention in the article of how to override that decision then. Essentially, Wise believes by waiting until the final night to pass a majority of the bills, as lawmakers often do, the legislature is giving up their constitutional power to override a veto.
The governor's veto power is not unique. I mean, every governor has some veto power, and the president of the United States. What really needs to be looked at then, to me, is does the legislature have the tools it needs in order to be able to perform its functions in a timely manner, in a quality manner, and is the legislature acting in a timely fashion?
Wise maintains lawmakers are working on bills throughout the interim sessions, and often they're pieces of legislation that aren't coming up for the first time. There are typically a large number of bills being reconsidered that didn't pass in previous sessions and are reworked during the legislative process.
What is critical, though, in this balance of power is, yes, the governor should be the strong executive, but the legislature should make sure that the legislature has the tools that it needs in staff, in materials, whatever it needs, in order to perform its functions too. When both are able to function at their maximum productivity and effectiveness, then we get the best government.
Armstead says even if lawmakers were able to more evenly spread out the passage of bills and get more through before the final night, you'd still have those pieces of legislation that aren't passed until the end, whether because they're complex, they're political, or just because of timing. One arena the governor holds a majority of the authority in is setting the budget. His office sets the revenue estimates for the fiscal year, giving the legislature a parameter to work within. His office creates its own budget, setting the policy priorities for funding, which the legislature can change. But the governor can ultimately go back in and strike out or change any amount by exercising a line item veto. That's what we saw last month when Tomlin was criticized for slashing tens of millions from family and senior services. Gubernatorial budget powers were expanded in West Virginia in 1968, with the passage of a constitutional amendment benefiting then-Republican Governor Arch Moore. His modern budget amendment meant, for the first time, the governor and his staff would fully prepare the proposed budget, as opposed to the governor and Board of Public Works coming to an agreement on spending. The amendment at the time was ratified by the people of the state, but that's after the legislature approved it. Giving away more of their influence? It's debatable. Ted Bettner, executive director for the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, said in an interview in January, the governor's powers in the budget realm should be dispersed more evenly with the legislature. He says that makes the process more democratic and more transparent. But Senate Finance Chairman Roman Prezioso says the governor's office needs to have that power.
The governor is the CEO. It's no different from any big business or corporation where you have an individual that's the head of the company. It's that person's responsibility to set the parameters and the guidelines for their particular industry, and it's no different for the governor setting the parameters and guidelines for the state of West Virginia. Somebody has to do it. He is bound to work with the agencies to determine their best function and efficiency, and then present that budget to us.
Wise says the line item veto, which he estimates he exercised twice in his tenure, is also a check on lawmakers who may stray from the big picture.
What it also does is it permits the governor to remove some spending that might look good to an individual legislator, but not so good for the overall budget, or perhaps is what some people might call pork.
The constitutional requirement to balance the budget also falls on the shoulders of the governor, Wise says, and in tough economic times when the legislature isn't around, the executive needs to be able to make decisions to balance the budget. Then there are the general veto powers, as Tomlin exercised against the legislatively approved abortion bill. In his veto message to Secretary of State Natalie Tennant, Tomlin wrote, quote, I hereby disapprove and return enrolled House Bill 4588. I am advised the bill is unconstitutional under controlling precedent of the Supreme Court of the United States, end quote. The federal Supreme Court has already overturned an Arizona bill containing a very similar post-20-week ban, as well as written other decisions disapproving the practice of limiting a woman's ability to get an abortion before what's considered the stage of viability, or 24 weeks. With that, The West Virginia bill was shot down, even after passing both chambers with an overwhelming majority. The House supported the measure on a vote of 83-15, and in the Senate, 29-5. Since the disapproval, Democrats and Republicans alike have expressed concern over the decision, going as far as calling for a special session to override the veto. But that's where the constitutional question has evolved. Under our current system, can the legislature override a veto after the regular session has adjourned? Armstead says he thinks the answer is obvious.
I believe the Constitution, while it's silent and it could be more clear on that issue, I believe the Constitution allows us to go back into session and override a veto.
But other members of the House are not so sure. House attorneys are currently researching their options, as confirmed by General Counsel for the Chamber Joe Altizer, but declined to release any specifics on what exactly they're looking into or who has ordered the research. One document, however, attorneys may be studying is a West Virginia Supreme Court decision from 1909. In May versus Topping, Maud May's husband, Attorney General Clark May, passed away after his annual salary was approved by the legislature, but before the governor vetoed it. May was asking the court, as the executor of her husband's estate, to order then House Clerk C.L. Topping to pay her that $2,000-some salary as the legislature had approved. The court ultimately ruled in May's favor, saying while the governor did have 5 days to enroll his objections to the appropriation, he did so after the legislature had adjourned, preventing him from returning the bill to its originating chamber for reconsideration and a possible override. In a larger sense, the court decision says the ultimate veto power is reserved for the people who are represented by their legislators. The court summed up any future doubt in who may hold the ultimate power by saying, quote, "Thus we see that the legislative, not the executive will, has been made supreme. Is it not the legislative will in whose favor such doubt should be resolved?" End quote. The court was saying, should there be any doubt in who has the final say over a proposed law, the doubt should be resolved by assuming the legislature has the ultimate power. But officials from the governor's office, who declined to be interviewed for this story, maintained by choosing to adjourn sine die, the legislature in the 1909 case and in the 2014 question left the ultimate power up to the governor. Therefore, a vetoed bill is dead. But Armstead says it comes back to decades of the legislature deferring its power to the office of governor.
I think it's important from a legislative standpoint that we do our job and we don't cede any of that role to the courts or to the governor. I think it's important that the governor do his job and not cede those powers to the legislature or the courts. Not because it's a power issue or anything. It's just because it's how it works. And I think what I think we're seeing to some degree have been seeing over the years is it's more of a political deference.
Armstead and other House Republicans have called on Attorney General Patrick Morrissey for an official modern opinion on the issue. In a letter dated April 9th addressed to legislative leaders, Morrissey concluded the legislature could override a veto in a legislatively initiated special session. That means a session called after 3/5 of the members of each chamber petition the governor. Morrissey ends the letter, however, by saying, quote, "We have found no court case deciding the authority of a legislature-initiated special session to override such a veto, nor have we located any examples of such a special session attempting to override such a veto," end quote. He writes, "Lawmakers should caution testing such power when it takes only a simple majority to override the governor's veto." Morrissey suggests instead, lawmakers could call themselves into session, pass another bill essentially with the same language, recess to await the inevitable second veto, and override it with the same simple majority vote it took to pass the bill in the first place. Governor Tomlin is already calling for a special session during May interims to address overtime issues with a recently approved bill to increase the state minimum wage. But as per his constitutional powers, since he is calling the special session, he also retains the right to set the agenda. However, as Morrissey states, should the legislature call themselves back into session, they reserve the right to set the agenda. And his stance is backed by an opinion written in 1954 by then Attorney General John Fox. In that opinion, Fox writes, when the legislature petitions themselves into session, they should be considered to be in a plenary or open session and can act, quote, on any subject not interdicted by the Constitution itself. However, he maintains should the governor call that session, lawmakers are bound to the governor's agenda with some flexibility in its interpretation. That means for the May session, legislators could not take up the abortion bill unless the governor decides to put it in the call, which is unlikely. Instead, if a decision is made to attempt an override or vote on a new bill, as Morrissey suggests, lawmakers must petition the governor themselves. While it's difficult to find all of the cases in which lawmakers have called their own sessions, the documents studied for this story indicated only two: a special session called in the 1860s under the state's first governor, Arthur Borman, and in the 1980s under Governor Jay Rockefeller. As research into the constitutional powers continues at the legislature, the question arises, are we seeing an increased concentration on the balance of power because of a narrowing gap between the parties? Armstead says it's possible.
So I think that's one thing that I'd like to see, the legislature come back into its role a little more. And that's not a criticism necessarily of the legislature, but it's a criticism of what has happened, I think, over the last few decades, where we've become so deferential to the governor.
However, former Governor Bob Wise says it's not political, it's structural.
My observation is that there is a natural tension between the governor, the legislature, and the Supreme Court. And even when one party might have a great clear dominance in the Senate and the House, you still had different factions within that party that were always pressing to either limit the governor's power or to somehow alter the balance of power. So this is, to me, not necessarily partisan. It's just a natural tension that exists between the legislative branches. This is a natural process regardless of what party's in control.
A natural tension between two branches that often appear to be at odds. It remains to be seen, however, if a battle over abortions and the budget will sway the current balance of power. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara.
The federal utility operating a coal-fired plant in Muhlenberg County, Kentucky, says this past week's Supreme Court decision won't change the plans for the facility. The High Court ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency has the authority to regulate emissions from coal-fired plants that cross state lines, a key part of the Obama administration's agenda. Tennessee Valley Authority spokesman Scott Brooks says the decision won't impact the Paradise Fossil Plant in Muhlenberg County.
Because we're already retiring coal units and moving toward a balanced portfolio that includes more gas, more nuclear, and a little bit less coal. So we're trying to find that sweet spot of a diversified portfolio.
Brooks says the TVA is currently clearing land near the Muhlenberg County plant where a new combined cycle gas plant will be built. The utility's board of directors voted in late 2013 to keep the plant in Drakesboro open, but with major changes. One of three units at the facility will continue burning coal while the other two units will be converted to natural gas. The White House's desire to more tightly regulate coal emissions has come under intense fire from many Republican lawmakers, including Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The small town of Richwood, West Virginia, has had a booming lumber and coal economy, but since the 1980s, most of the jobs in town have left the area, as has 42% of the population. Every dollar is needed here, and the town relies on its annual Feast of the Ransom to help rejuvenate the local economy each April. Traveling 219's Roxy Todd went to the ramp feed, and she brings us this story from conversations with two young people in a town with a disappearing population.
Inside the cafeteria, the air is saturated with the smell of ramps, a pungent, garlicky, peppery smell, so strong that it eclipses everything in the room. A local musician, John Wyatt, is playing a song he wrote about the Richwood ramp feed.
when the maple buds turn red on the hillside and the harvest trees are blooming in the lane and the ramps begin to grow.
My parents have been telling me all the time about how big the town used to be back when my older brothers and sisters went to school here.
Ridgewood in the spring, where there's ramps to say the least, and our annual
about six vendors are selling ramps today out of truck beds along the highway. Families are together sitting on camping chairs and coolers. Helping his family sell ramps for $4 a pound is 11-year-old Tyler McCune. His blue eyes squint in the sun as he tells me with pride that his grandfather taught him how to dig and preserve the patches of wild ramps in the forest near his home.
We're in Richwood, West Virginia, at the ramp feed called the Ramps. And I love this town. I love it. It's not very big, not very much, but it's just home. You can go half a mile up the road, catch your fish, dig your ramps, and just up here enjoying my time selling ramps and just having fun with my family. Yeah, I'll never leave it.
You'll never leave it?
I'll go and go somewhere where there's more jobs. There's mines and stuff up here. But I don't really want a coal mine because then I won't be able to spend time with my family. But I could always go do that or make my own business. But I want to be a lawyer. Yeah, I go to college for a game warden too up at Monongahela National Forest. I'd like to be one there. Be a park ranger.
Tyler says he sees some people that come from out of town to dig ramps. He's worried that they're taking more than the forest here can sustain.
Overpickers, yeah, you know, they like dig every ramp they see. See, you can't do that here. I mean, you can dig a lot of ramps, but you can at least leave some roots behind, that way they'll grow. Keep your ecosystem and all that going. Keep the ramp cycle going, but it'll feed your family. We'll be able to keep having this good ramp feed up here in Richwood. Everybody enjoys. I enjoy it.
When the maple buds turn red on the hillside and the harvest trees are blooming in the lane and the ramps begin to grow in the mountains, then I know that it's springtime again. When the ramps begin to grow in the mountains, then I know that it's spring time again.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This story was produced by Roxy Todd of the Traveling 219 Project. For more information about ramps, visit traveling219.com. While many folks go out into the woods foraging for ramps this time of year, others are looking for spring wildflowers. These often tiny treasures can easily blend into the landscape and be hard to see. But as the Allegheny Front's Jennifer Zveta Jordan reports, with a good interpreter like Shane Miller of Raccoon Creek State Park at the helm, the world of southwestern Pennsylvania's wildflowers is wide open.
The reason I stopped here is there's a little plant that grows here that I kind of think of as the Rodney Dangerfield of plants. There's just some plants that just do not get respect. And this is one of them. Now you look at it, it has these tiny, tiny little white flowers, nothing too exciting, but in pioneer times, this was a very important plant. Let's say you were misfortunate enough to get lice. This is the plant you'd use to treat it. Also, let's say you wanted to make a little bag of potpourri. Put some leaves in it to prevent the critters from chewing on your winter clothes. This is the plant that you'd use. This one is commonly called cat's toes or mouse's toes because it kind of looks like they're fuzzy little toes. Let me show you one other interesting thing. Let's say it doesn't have the flowers on it. If you turn its leaf over, it's metallic silver. Look at that. Isn't that cool?
I've already seen more than I normally see on a hike.
The reason I stopped here is so I can let you folks know we need to form a single file line to head down this next trail. It is a narrow trail that winds down into the valley here, and then it opens up down at the bottom. We have five different species of trilliums that are here. We have the snow trilliums, which bloom when there's snow out. We also have toad shade that we'll bump into. We also have the wake robin, which is around when the robins are around. He's named Remember. We also have the big white one, which is the large flowering trillium. And we have also what's called the declining trillium, which is a beautiful but unusual trillium that bows down to the ground where you don't see it, and it has a completely white center. So it doesn't have a purple center like the ones these folks are enjoying. Yes, that is a trillium.
It looks like a four-leaf clover with a white flower and like a little pine cone in the middle, like a robin egg.
You can take a look at a plant that's called toad shade. Years ago, pioneers and settlers actually believed that stinky little red trillium over there, and in the springtime, it will have leaves that are green and purple, toads hid under. Well, for the past 10 years, I've been looking and have not found any toads hiding under them, but it's kind of a fun story to remember its name, toad shade.
Poison ivy.
I'm allergic, but I get it all the time. That's
whoa! The purple flower that I was pointing out that was on the right-hand side of the trail is one that I bet most of you have in your garden but don't even realize it. That plant is called dwarf delphinium or dwarf larkspur. It's called dwarf because it's a small one. But if you look closely at it, we're going to walk by more of them. There's two different names for it, the delphinium and the larkspur. Well, delphinium actually refers to the shape of the dolphin. So if you look closely at this, towards the back of it, there's this little spike that comes out that's supposed to look like a dolphin. I think it takes a little bit of imagination, but I can kind of see where it comes from. The other one, which is larkspur, where does that come from? Well, years ago, they used to call it lark's foot, and a lark is a springtime bird that you'd see. Now, imagine its foot, but purple, and attached to these flowers. Interesting names. I don't often get to talk about dolphins in the middle of Pennsylvania, but we have a flower that supposedly looks like one.
That was interpreter Shane Miller at Raccoon Creek State Park Wildflower Reserve.
That's Jennifer Jvetta Jordan. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Three times a month, members of a group get together in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, to focus on quilting. The Delectable Mountains Quilt Guild has almost 70 members from West Virginia and nearby Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania.
This demo is for the 12-inch block.
During a recent meeting at a local church hall, some in attendance gathered around a table with a sewing machine where Portia Lyle gave instructions on making the block of the month.
And again, if you have problems doing this, slow your machine down. I'm doing a demonstration on block of the month, which is blocks we're doing for the Underground Railroad by Eleanor Burns.
You're going to clip that. Why do you clip that? You just folded it in half.
Each member is making a quilt based on a pattern in a book. The Block of the Month demonstrations teach them how to construct one of the 16 blocks in this quilt. In this case, member Kim Wibbing says the quilt pattern reflects the theory that slaves used quilts to communicate.
Each of the blocks have a story in regard to the slaves during the Civil War and how they escaped slavery and moved north. And each of the blocks, because they used quilts to let the slaves know who was friendly and who wasn't, things like that. But what's neat about these blocks is each of them have a meaning to them. So this is going to be the finished block quilt when we're done, 16 blocks. We're learning the technique as well as building our own quilts. And each of us will be able to show our quilts at the end because we're going to finish them individually. The block material is going to be very similar, but the sashes and the borders and everything are going to be different. So each of us will have our own input into our quilts. And then at the end, we'll display them and show everybody what we did.
Why do you like to, I mean, what's the benefit of doing a block of the month and then everyone doing their own quilt and seeing the result?
I think besides learning the technique, because a lot of us are learning new skills in this quilt, it's something that we're all working together. So we can talk to each other about our blocks, we can email each other. And, of course, we're learning the story of the slaves and how they used the quilts to help them to reach freedom up north and into Canada.
You look like you enjoy this a lot.
Oh, I love the Civil War period because there's a lot of history in it, obviously, in these quilts. And I love the materials, the reproduction fabrics that we're using. So the more muted earth tone colors.
Guild President Karen Hayes says the group started more than 30 years ago with members meeting at churches to socialize and teach each other quilting techniques.
We have a lot of knowledgeable people in our quilt guild who can help others. They can help beginners get started, and they can help with any new technique that's come on the market.
Today, the Quilt Guild offers both day and night meetings each month so those who work can still participate. Hayes, like most of the women attending this meeting, wears a small quilted square name tag decorated with pins and charms.
When you pay your dues the first time, you're given the pattern for a name tag and our green pin to start with. And then this is a 30-year pin. These are we made last December. They're called Lynn's pins. And each of these charms is for a charity quilt or a yard square that was given for the auction.
The auction Hayes refers to is a project the Quilt Guild has done for 10 years. Members make pieces that are on display throughout downtown Berkeley Springs and will be sold on Memorial Day weekend. During this particular meeting, Guild members proudly parade the squares for everyone to see.
This is My Night Sky by Kathy Swanigan.
They're 36 inches square, and they're beautiful. We have 40 of them available this year, and they will be auctioned off, and the proceeds will go to a charity that we all voted on.
This is Patriotism, again by Mary Roach.
In recent years, the proceeds have gone to charities like the Morgan Arts Council, the Morgan County Public Library, and the Humane Society. This year's recipient will be the Morgan County Observatory Foundation, which supports an observatory located next to a local elementary school.
Now she tells you to fold your fabric.
Whether they've been quilting for years or have just started, members of the Delectable Mountains Quilt Guild come from near and far every month to get together, enjoy each other's company, and share their craft.
Oh, I'm Jane Frankie. I love the diversity of the outlooks. I love the technical skills that everybody brings. There are amazing hand piecing, hand applique, hand quilters. And then there's me, who is machine all the way. And just seeing the diversity and the color sense and the fun that everyone puts into their quilts, it's exciting and it's inspirational. So,
learning and the camaraderie. My name's Shirley Withrow. I joined about 8 years ago, and I just something new for me, and it's a challenge. And I enjoy it. Yeah.
I'm Julie Beckham, and I'm retired, so this gives me a place to go and meet other, you know, people who have the same interests that I have. And I like the camaraderie. And I'm learning the skill that I hope I pass on my quilts to my grandchildren and they become family heirlooms.
I'm Shirley Hilgren, and I love the Guild because of all the camaraderie and the new things I learn.
What kind of new things do you learn?
Oh, I've been a member for a little over 10 years, and I have learned all sorts of new things because I wasn't a quilter when I first started.
Oh, so you were a novice.
I was. I was a beginner, and I joined the Guild when I retired, and I really do enjoy it.
And why do you like quilting?
It's a creative outlet, and it also gives you a lot of quiet, meditative time as you work on your quilt. So it's an enjoyable pastime.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.